Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This week we've been speaking with some of the speakers coming to New York for the Personal Democracy Forum next week at Lincoln Center, a two-day conference about using the internet to make democracy more responsive. We will conclude that series now with two of the conference organizers who also have a new book. Andrew Roche is a social entrepreneur and founder of the Personal Democracy Forum. You may remember he ran for New York City Public Advocate in the last election cycle on a platform featuring free citywide high-speed internet, Wi-Fi. Allison Fine is also a social entrepreneur, and we're going to ask both of you what that term means, and a senior editor at Personal Democracy Forum, a frequent contributor to Huffington Post and more, and they are two editors of the new book, Rebooting America, Ideas for Redesigning American Democracy for the Internet Age, which asks such provocative questions as, who needs elected officials? That's one of the chapter titles. Andrew, welcome back. Allison, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Good morning.
Pleasure to be here.
Can you both start with the basic idea behind the Personal Democracy Forum? Is personal democracy, Andrew, different from public democracy?
Well, I think that in the age of the Internet, we're learning that personalization, the ability to be able to find information that's most relevant to you and to be able to share that information with many others and not live in a world where we're saturated with top-down communications is starting to impact politics as well. And so generally people view politics as somewhat of an abstract process. They feel disconnected from it and they feel separated from their elected officials and from the governmental processes that control parts of their lives. And the Internet is disintermediating the entire landscape and allowing people to choose how to participate and make politics relevant.
Allison, do you want to muse on that? Is there a distinction here between personal democracy and public democracy?
No, I think they're becoming one and the same, just as we're seeing in all sectors of life now. We're seeing it in commerce. So eBay is allowing people to become their own entrepreneurs and their own buyers and sellers. We're seeing it with something like Wikipedia, where a host of people can become knowledge creators. And we've certainly seen it in campaigns, political campaigns, over the last 5 years or so. And now with this book and with the conference next week, what we're saying is what happens if you take that same lens of empowering individuals and giving them all these wonderful tools for connecting with one another and train that on government and public policy.
Now, Andrew, in your chapter in the book, you question the whole idea of representative democracy as we usually think of it. Do you think representative democracy is out of date?
Well, I think it's going to change dramatically because the forefathers originally thought that people were too busy toiling in the fields, in effect, to be able to pay attention to what's going on with government, and so they were going to do it for us. But what we've seen over the last 200 years is them spending all their time raising money to keep themselves in office, and actually they know less than most people out in the world do about the problems that people are actually having. And so if you take the notion of collective, the wisdom of crowds, and the fact that the whole may know more than the individual representatives, we're talking about a wholesale reboot of the way in which the best information might come to fore.
So you say democracy is changing whether the representatives like it or not. You think they're back on their heels now because of Facebook and YouTube and things like that?
Well, certainly there's this issue of the fact that the Internet is an organism that has a memory older than itself, and they have to start remembering what they said 5 or 10 years ago. And so ultimately elected officials are going to now probably be more transparent and probably telling us more of the truth because they know that by parsing it, they may get themselves in trouble.
And Allison, your chapter in the book calls for online voting. Do you really mean people voting from their laptops rather than going to any kind of public place for a voting booth?
Absolutely, Brian. My dream is that on election day, walking down the street, we'll see people pull out their handheld PDAs and vote right then and there. There's no reason for it. You know, on this Tuesday, there was a special election in Maryland that elected Donna Edwards to Congress that cost $1.5 million. That's an obscene amount of money for an election that actually only had less than 5% of the electorate turnout. So there are much easier ways to allow much larger numbers of people to vote if we can become less afraid of using the technology that everybody is using in their everyday lives.
You know that progressives are the ones, I don't have to tell you, sounding the alarm about the amount of electronic voting that we have already. They go after voting machine companies like Diebold and say, without a paper trail, these electronic voting machines are ripe for nefarious hacking. You think that concern is overblown,
Andrew? No, I think that we should be concerned about that. But I think our theme is a much larger one, that these kinds of issues are going to eventually get sorted out. And whether you're voting on your handheld or whether you're voting electronically at a voting booth, the issue is that the Internet is changing the way people are going to be able to express their opinions. And maybe we'll get to a point where you can still vote, but maybe you'll be able to leave a comment as to what your vote is. It doesn't necessarily change your vote, but maybe we can get a collective view of how everybody thinks about the situation, and maybe people can participate more by feeling that their voices are being heard more than just the yes or no on a voting booth.
You know, and I think this is reflective, this conversation, of the phrase you used just a few minutes ago of elected officials and government officials feeling pushed back on their heels and just terrified of this new connected age, that we're having to drag them into it to use the new technologies, as opposed to their enthusiastic willingness to open themselves up, to be more transparent. You just had a segment a few minutes ago of who the heck are the MTA officials. We don't even know who they are, much less what they do.
Right?
And all of these wonderful tools are out there. So it's really what we're trying to do with the book is move from last century, where something like the Freedom of Information Act was seen as a good thing, to this century, where the idea that we have to beg the information beg the government for information makes no sense at all with all the tools that we have available.
Now, listeners, speaking of personal democracy online, why don't you post a comment on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Some of you already have, anticipating this segment, and we'll read a couple of those in a minute. Or you can call us up. Our temporary phone number in our new space, 646-778-3729, 646-SPUDRAY, if you prefer, 646-778-3729 or 646-SPUDRAY. And my guests, if you're just joining us, are two of the editors of Rebooting America, Ideas for Redesigning American Democracy for the Internet Age, Allison Fine and Andrew Roche, also two of the organizers of the Personal Democracy Forum at Lincoln Center next week. So here's a comment from Tony in San Jose, California, who's listening and writes, the problem with Internet voting or electronic voting is not technical. There are methods that can guarantee accurate, secret, and fair voting. All the problems with current voting machines come from knuckleheads designing the systems. However, he writes, the problem is verification by outside sources. You want your 80-year-old grandma to be able to verify that the system is fair? One has to know quite advanced mathematics to understand how these voting systems work. With pencil and paper, he writes, almost anyone can verify that the count is accurate.
I understand the concerns there, and as Andrew mentioned a few minutes ago, there are hurdles that would need to be overcome for a system like this. But I think that we are, as a society, up to the challenge, both technologically and, as the commenter just mentioned, procedurally, of creating a system that is very easy to access and very easy to verify. And the question, Brian, is do we want to continue to pretend that we're in the 18th century with our voting system, or do we want to have a system that reflects the way that people, particularly young people, are living and working in this new age?
Andrew, to change the topic a little bit, how do you feel about Obama opting out of the public financing spending limits, the first major presidential nominee ever to do it? The good government groups like Common Cause are drilling him today. But I wonder if you, with your personal democracy orientation, think his online fundraising and the fact that he's gotten so many small donors that way is a greater good.
Well, Barack Obama's agreeing or stating that he's going to opt out is sort of like saying that he's taking a bunch of broken eggs and giving us a new omelet. And it's not really that much different than the old omelet. It would have been.
You think it's not that much different?
Well, I mean, I think that it's all about perception here, because the reality of it is that there are very large groups of that are going to raise a lot of money, that are going to have a voice in this election. And what will be interesting is to see what the influence is going to be of those voices on the political system. So what he's saying is that we have a broken system and I'm going to opt out of it, but the other parts of the system still remain broken. It would have been better, I think, if he had agreed to limit his donations to $250 max for any single donor. And if he would have called on some of the large progressive groups, which such as the unions and others, to hold back from these kinds of attacks. In fact, Adam Green yesterday, I think, mentioned the fact that that was sort of the idea. But I didn't hear from Barack a very loud call for progressives to hold back. I mean, the reality of it is he knows he can raise a huge amount of money online, way more than the $85 million. So he's opting for the people financing as opposed to public financing.
Do you want to react to Adam Green from MoveOn.org on this show yesterday? He's going to be one of the participants at Personal Democracy Forum, and that's why he was here. But I cited for him a quote of you from another conference earlier in the week where you said, and I'm paraphrasing, so you'll tell me how close I got it, that MoveOn is 20th century organizing because they're still top down. And the Obama campaign has really gone the next step and is more 21st century organizing because it's more bottom up.
Well, it's true. What I really meant to say about MoveOn was that there are two schools in the use of technology in politics. One is that uses these tools, these amazing tools for top down political organizing. And then there are other organizations like the Sunlight Foundation and others that use the technology for bottom up and getting more people involved. And in MoveOn's case, they do sort of set an agenda, and yes, occasionally they do ask their members to participate, but they're not introducing their members to each other in a robust way. They might meet at house parties, but they're not turning MoveOn into a Facebook for politics. And the power there could be exponential if they were to really harness in total the power of their own constituency.
Let's take a call. Elizabeth in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was just wondering about how poor people are going to be involved in, in electronic voting or in internet-style voting, because
they don't have PDAs.
They don't have exactly.
No, but they do have cell phones, and we're seeing this merger of digital technology that is handheld.
Many do, many don't.
Well, I think if you look at the data, Brian, on the digital divide. I think people are stuck about 5-6 years ago where there was really a significant divide. If you're looking at it now, particularly for young people, the divide is closing very, very quickly. We have much more of a generational divide when it comes to technology than we do an income divide.
Elizabeth, you satisfied with that?
I'm fairly satisfied. I'm not 100% convinced. I have spent a significant amount of time out in the Mott Haven section of the Bronx, and my experience being out there on the streets was that, there were a lot of people who didn't have cell phones or who wouldn't use them or who weren't politically activated by the internet. I mean, the internet, has activated people of my generation, but I have reservations.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. Now, let me see if I can put two people on together here. I don't know if I can. I'm going to try Joyce in Manhattan and Tony in Hoboken. Tony, you there? Tony, you there? Joyce, are you there? Oh, okay, so I'm going to have to do you one at a time. We don't have all the bugs out of our new studios yet, beautiful as they are. How about, okay, let's see. So if I undo that, sorry to do this on the air, folks. Trying to get to one of them. Can I get to, okay, Tony. Tony, I think we got you, right?
Yes, you have me.
Go ahead.
I haven't used paper in about 3 years. So I use a tablet PC for everything. Wouldn't know how to use a file cabinet if my life depended on it. And there's no way you could convince me that if I placed a vote on my cell phone, it couldn't be connected back to me. So there's no...
Oh, that's really interesting. And that actually goes to a segment we're going to have next hour on privacy and changing generational notions of privacy in the internet and cell phone age. But there are all these records of pretty much every, every key you punch.
I think that we've slightly gone off track because we're not advocating for internet voting with this project. What we're trying to say is that the internet is allowing us to redesign our Constitution. If our forefathers had originally had thought that it could be amended, the internet is actually amending it on the fly.
Sure. That's the big picture, to be sure. But people are reacting to Allison's chapter in the book.
Right.
And so there's a privacy concern, a secret ballot concern.
Listen, and as I say in the essay, Brian, we could go through a litany of concerns about security, about privacy, about access issues. They're real. They exist today. What we're trying to say in the book, though, is what kind of society do we want to be? Do we want to be one that's limited by our fears and concerns, or one that is excited and activated by all the possibilities that the technology offers? We're not advocating for throwing the whole government out today and starting the whole thing over with a wiki. But we are saying that there are real exciting possibilities for governing differently, for involving people in widespread, interesting ways, and that we need to start now to do this aggressively and energetically.
Here's an interesting post on our comments page from someone who asks, it's a question really, any thoughts on media echo chamber effects?
Yeah.
Does new media tend to amplify them? How would this tend to influence a more directly democratic governance structure? And I do notice that there's one of the chapters in the book by one of your contributors called Echo Chambers Equals Democracy.
David Weinberger.
Yeah, this is...
And this is, when we say echo chambers, we're usually thinking of people dividing themselves up into communities that only, you know, read and listen to and interact with the media they agree with.
Right.
And that's a bad thing.
Right.
But this says media echo chambers equals democracy. You're smiling.
Because one of the most interesting and fun parts about putting the book together was we went out to all of these essayists and asked them all the same question. If you could put the pieces together, if you were a founder of the country and you had all the social media available to you and you put the pieces together, what would you do differently? And one of the concerns when you do that, Brian, as you can imagine, we were fearful we're going to get 44 essays about municipal Wi-Fi. But we didn't. We got these really interesting comments. And so we have this juxtaposition of David Weinberger, who's a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, saying that echo chambers really are like-minded people coming together and having conversations, in this case about democracy and government, which is how human beings learn. And then we had other essayists like Dana Boyd and Marty Kearns saying that these echo chambers are a danger to democracy and we have to find ways to cut across.
You know, we're going
to
have to come back to that and do that one as a separate segment on the show one of these days, because I think that's going to be really fascinating for some of our listeners. Before we run out of time, I just want to clarify some things about the Personal Democracy Forum coming up next week itself, since we've been doing some programming around it this week. Number one, I've been saying at Lincoln Center as a shorthand. It's at Jazz at Lincoln Center, the Rose Hall, at the Time Warner Center, at Columbus Circle. It's not Lincoln Center's main campus, so
correct,
just to be clear that that's where it is. However, Andrew, tell me if I'm wrong. This is not really for the general public to come and see one session or another. This is a hundreds of dollar ticket for people who want to participate in a conference. Is that correct?
That's correct. There is a fee. There are fees slightly lower for students and also for non-for-profits. But this is unfortunately, in our day and age, to put together a conference in a physical facility that can accommodate 1,000 people costs money. So we have to cover various pieces of it. But the idea is to have a conversation. And what's interesting is that this is Republicans and Democrats coming together in a same forum talking about the role of technology in government and in democracy.
And that's one of the reasons, and since I'm interested in this world and my producers are, that we've been doing some programming around it, obviously for free this week, so we could bring some of that conference out to the public that, you know, that can't attend the conference. And we'll be doing more after I spend some of Monday and Tuesday there hosting one of the sessions and interviewing some of the participants. So we've got 30 seconds. Give me a 15-second definition, Allison, of social entrepreneur. You both call yourselves that.
Well, it's people who can't get another job, but it's people who are using all sorts of interesting business approaches to solving social problems, whether it's a for-profit or a nonprofit.
And in my view, it's a person or the process by which you create value that's far more important than money, and using your energy to create good in the world as opposed to wealth.
Allison Fine and Andrew Roche are two of the editors of Rebooting America, Ideas for Redesigning American Democracy for the Internet Age, just published with a foreword by Esther Dyson. They're also two of the organizers of the Personal Democracy Forum next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, another hour to come.